This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. And this morning we have the great privilege of having a conductor from the Santa Fe Opera, the conductor of Cold Mountain, here with us. And Desiree Mays is going to have a conversation with him this morning. Good morning, Desiree.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. I'm back.
It's great to have you back. And in fact, next week we're going to be rerunning the opera series.
Yes, that's right. Everyone can listen to that and hear about an hour on each show. So
that's
if
right.
You haven't got your tickets, you'll know all about it next week.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, I am really thrilled and excited to introduce my guest, the maestro Miguel Hauth Bedoya. He is from Lima, Peru, but he's sort of a gypsy too. He's the chief conductor for the Norwegian Radio Orchestra in Oslo, and he is the music director at the Fort Worth Symphony Orchestra in Texas. He is here in Santa Fe to conduct the premiere performances of Jennifer Higdon's Cold Mountain, which we are very excited. Welcome, Miguel.
Thank you, Desiree.
How great to have you here. So we're going to talk a little bit about Cold Mountain and then switch to the big project that you are so deeply involved in, Caminos del Inca. But let's talk first about Cold Mountain. How and when did you get involved with Jennifer Higdon? When did she approach you and how did you get into this big project of Cold Mountain?
Well, I was approached to conduct the world premiere of Cold Mountain when the plans were set, as in when the creative team was put in place. So we're going back, you know, several years.
Yes.
And I was not part of the creative process, which is actually a very good thing, because as a conductor, I get a final product, having studied the process of creation. Mm-hmm. And so I take no sides on anybody. And that's actually the perfect situation to be in. But this piece, starting with the various sketches of the librettos and the scores, have been roaming my mind for, you know, a good year and a half since I saw things on paper.
Yes, because it's a long time since Jennifer started with the book, which mm-hmm. you must have read, I mm-hmm. suppose,
oh,
beforehand,
yes.
and then got to the score right mm-hmm. up to the present day, well, last week, when things were still being changed, right? Nobody had heard the music. I mean, this was the big, we all knew about the opera, but we had not heard the music. So talk to us a little bit about that collaborative process with her once you and she did sit down with the full score. What sort of give and take is there? Because it's her first opera for her, not for you.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you guide her, so to speak, and work with her on that path?
Well, when I saw the score a little over a year ago, I had some suggestions. I would say I don't think I changed anything. Firstly, how to lay out the orchestral parts, you know, with rehearsal numbers, cues, and key points that could guide the whole process much more efficiently, which were incorporated into it. And then the next question was that I was the only one, and perhaps her, that we could hear the end result, because mm-hmm. we're looking at the whole score and we can hear all the sounds in our head. So that was very difficult to translate to anybody until orchestra mm-hmm. and singing came together. Now, actually, Jennifer and I never had the chance to sit down properly to discuss the score in person,
wow.
even though we were collaborating on other scores. You know,
you did it telepathically.
Well, I think it was a given. It was so clear that when I arrived here a few days before she did, I was just texting her a few questions and comments, you know, or actually take a picture of the point in question, text it to her, and she would reply back.
Great.
Or something. So because things were so minuscule, you know, there were not real structural changes, which is the best situation to be in. If you have a composer really changing the backbone of a piece, then that's not a good sign.
No, it's
so fine. This piece has been standing from the very beginning, you know, with a good libretto and good music and very strong feet from day one.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of changes were there when you got here and you suddenly were with production and singers, and there had to have been some tweaking?
For instance, as a foreigner, I hear English differently, you know, and I speak other languages as well. And English is still one of the hardest languages for me to pronounce, and still a very difficult language to sing in. You know, the amount of vowels, possibilities. And one of them was the negative for can't. So if it's thrown too quickly and you say, I can't do that, well, actually, did you say you can do that or you can't do that?
Mm.
So I would, you know, listen over and over to that particular point, and I would confirm with Erie, the English diction coach, and say, can you actually, if you don't read the liberal, can you hear the negative?
Mm.
Oh, right. So that means that the rhythm could be altered by a fraction or reversed. So I would ask Jennifer, here, I can't hear the negative because it's essential.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, sure. And there would be a question of an eighth note versus a quarter, like reverse something so small that now you can hear it's the negative.
But that's a major, major thing to do,
well,
because you're dealing with the libretto. In this case, you don't have to change the libretto,
mm-hmm.
but there must have been times where the libretto words didn't work. Did the singers have problems with certain words that they would have preferred changed or maneuvered?
Well, for different notes of their passaggio, for instance, or places where things would sit more comfortable per voice, there were a slight, shall we say, shifting maybe of vowels or delaying or adjusting. But not changing. I wouldn't call that changing it, but they were minor. In a couple of instances, there was a question of the present versus the past. The storm is coming, the storm is hitting.
Mm.
And there was, for instance, a consensus between the production and the librettist, because if the storm, if you can see the storm, because it's projected, it's happening,
yes.
you can tell a story is coming because it's on top of you.
Yes.
So
yes,
things
yeah,
like that
yeah,
had to
yeah.
be agreed among everybody based on the moment of rehearsing or creating. And I think those are perfectly fine. And
mm-hmm.
maybe, I don't know if the score got changed forever or it's because this production needed, you know, the present rather than the future.
Yeah, I think the Gene Shear was very clear. He didn't want to be doing a sort of a past memories flipping forward and back. He wanted the whole thing in a sort of continuum moving forward. So
correct.
Even though it's a flashback, it's the character thinking about something that happened in the past but thinking
but
about
in
it in the present.
That's
correct. Very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult. Now, if there are even an eighth note change in the score, does that mean how the musicians just write that in? Because
yes.
you can't redo an entire score at this stage.
Correct. Well, yeah. believe it or not, you can print, measure at a time if you want to, and paste it on top of it or replace a page.
Yes,
with the software and all that, it's amazing what you can do.
Verdi never had that option.
Can you imagine
those days?
So in some cases, when we adjusted something in the orchestra after the first rehearsal, which is normal to adjust balances and things, Jennifer would just print or have the passage in question printed, so in the library we just put it on top of the old one, so people won't even have to change
and anything,
just see the new.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
how many musicians are in the orchestra for
this
opera?
That's a good one. 60, I'm guessing.
Oh, it's a fair number. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
92 for Salome, I understand.
Right.
That's a really tight fit in that in that pit. So 62.
Maybe a little more.
Talk a little bit about her style, because that's the big question. What's her music like? I mean, for people who don't know her symphonic music, she seems to come to this fully fledged. I mean, it's amazing for a first opera.
Yeah.
What are your feelings about her musical approach to this story?
The first comment I had to myself when I saw the score is, this is syllabic. So it's very syllabic, and I'm sure it has to do with the libretto, with the amount of things that needs to be said, need to be told. Fine, but that could be an opinion of mine. So at one point, in the middle of a rehearsal, I mentioned, the question of the negative has to do with the amount of syllables of consecutive sequence. And I said, well, what about, tying one syllable over two notes? No, la, instead of saying ta-ta.
Yeah.
I said, no, not too much of that. I said, okay. I said, so I kept digging, why? Well, think of rock and roll, she says. That's where I come from, in the sense that words and rhythm and syllables.
Yes.
And then it dawned on me, that's actually an aesthetic key element.
Mm-hmm.
Not because she needs to get through X amount of words, and therefore you have to. So only then I understood when she said, think of rock and roll. Think about that. Wow, there are no melismas.
Never.
Yes, yes, that's right. It's very hard.
So, but anyway, not to say that this music sounds like rock and roll, but that concept, I mean, I found it, sure, why didn't I, it didn't occur to me.
But she had thought it through. And what about the Appalachian sound?
All right, now then we come to sounds. Now, she has recreated, oh, these are her own creations of sound like Appalachian, you know, music. There's no copying of anything. Mm. There's no quotes from anything. So she's created all the tunes, the songs, the fiddling music that sounds like music from that area, except that it's all original, which is the best, because if you were just transcribing, well, that's kind of secondhand creation.
But given where the setting is, people are expecting something of that Appalachian sound.
Yeah, there's enough of that to make it work, particularly when you have a fiddler, when you actually have a person, whether in our case, Kevin Burdett, plays the fiddle.
Not only does he play the fiddle, but he sings at the same time.
Yeah, he sings and plays and actually plays enough. But if not, it's covering the orchestra. If a performer doesn't play, you can actually have it, you know, in the orchestra. But those are the key sounds that in the hands of one person, which is Stobroth, it's enough to set the whole pace. And now, this doesn't start the opera. What starts the opera is Teek's character, which is such a clever way, you know, the bad guy.
Yes. He's the home guard.
But he's introducing the opera with this charming... The
folk song.
But charming. I mean, if you didn't know who was singing, you could assume anyone, anybody going by singing the song. Mm-hmm. And that's how this starts. So I think, you know, elements like that are enough, not too many, not too little, give you the sense of where you are. Mm. You know, where you are geographically, where you are in the atmosphere, and probably where you would be in the time period. You know, yes, it sounds like a folk song, but a folk song could have endured for two centuries, pretty much the same or slightly different.
Civil War, roughly.
Civil, absolutely.
Right, yeah.
Sure,
but it didn't lock it into that period, because I think the statement this opera makes is that about the horror of the aftermath of the Civil War, but it could be any war.
Any war.
But
I mean, there are some harsh sounds, intentionally.
When you
see the slaughtering or the shooting, this was brutal. I mean, those fightings were... I mean, any fighting is terrible, but you see in this production how humanly brutal, war is.
And she has that in her score.
Oh, absolutely.
What instrumentation does she use for that percussion?
Oh, she has an unbelievable array of toys, as I call it, from pitch, from traditional, instruments like the glockenspiel, the bells, sleigh bells, even triangles, cymbals. She uses all kinds of sticks, like bamboo sticks hitting on rims of drums, cabasas, shakers, sandpaper.
Wow, all
these are very sort of organic sounds that make you connected to something rural, to something...
To the earth.
To the earth,
yes,
exactly.
Yeah. And the earthiness in the characters. How does she... the choruses are very special. Mm-hmm. I mean, the elegies in this piece are a hymn to the amazing... amazing feelings of these people who have died in some cases. She does that so wonderfully. But how does she handle the principals, Inman and Ada? Do they have, not motifs, but is there a sound or a type of scoring she uses for the lead characters?
Some. I mean, Inman is associated with the trombone, and it supports him here and there. Again, it's not generic like a la Wagner. Ada has, woodwinds, so there the male and female come apart already, and when they have duos, these things come along and support this. But I don't think they're meant to split your ears into, because otherwise you wouldn't have to stick to it, and it would be a very black and white proposition.
Right. And for you conducting, it must be very difficult, because in many cases they are on either side of the stage singing a duet. We know that they're together in thought,
but
how is it conducting
that? That's actually very complex, because not only are they front or back, they can be high and low.
Yes.
And they are in two different places, dramatically, and actually on stage they are, but musically they are together.
Right.
So this is when I say I only have two hands and two eyes and one mouth to supply two different texts.
It's a challenge. People don't realize, but it's the conductor who holds the whole thing together.
We just do it.
And you like to work with new pieces, I understand.
Yes.
You, why?
Well, there's something about the first time of anything. There's no second first time. And the excitement of translating, I suppose, or delivering a new score is just exciting. You can't go to anybody. You can't have the reference of anybody else. So that means the artistic challenge is so much greater, so much more exciting, that it's really in our hands to make that fine decision.
You're not reinventing, is it?
Nothing. You have no point of... And that's exciting. Very exciting to do, I have to say. I mean, some people don't like doing it. They'd rather have something as a reference. But now and then I like it, whether orchestral works or operas. This is the third opera I've premiered.
So that's great.
It never grows old on me.
So do you have a preference for symphony or opera?
Well, I started with the thought that I would be an opera conductor mainly. This is when I was working in Lima with Luigi Alva, you know, as backstage crew. That's where I started. And I did my fair share of traditional operas, you name it, Tosca, Balloon, Mascara, Butterfly, etc., etc. And then I was introduced to the symphonic world when I went to the Curtis Institute of Music and the Philadelphia Orchestra and Ricardo Muti, who swing both worlds. And so music is music, and maybe there is more that I haven't discovered yet. So I'm open to the composers bringing things to me, or me approaching composers, whether dead or alive, and see what is the best to do at the right moment. Mm-hmm. So operas, of course, have a challenging issue with the schedule, with having to be in one place for multiple weeks or months, and with families and all that. So I would say that at the moment I'm keeping a low profile and pace for operas, maybe every 3, 4, 5 years. And
yeah, because you have a young family, yes?
Yes, so we'll wait until they are grown and then
we'll see. Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, this is a nice segue into the second part of our discussion this morning, Maestro. The Maestro is the founder and artistic director of Caminos del Inca, a non-profit organization dedicated to discovering, preserving, disseminating the rich musical legacy of the Americas through cultural and musical research. So we're going to play a little piece of a very ancient piece of music, flute music, I think, and then let's talk about that. So we're talking this morning with Maestro Miguel Hath Bedoya, who is the conductor of the premier opera Cold Mountain at the Santa Fe Opera. And now we're going to shift gear a little bit to talk about Caminos del Inca, his special project of which he is the artistic director. Tell us about that.
Well, Caminos del Inca Incorporated is a non-for-profit organization after several years, perhaps over a decade, of unconsciously working on this, which is finding the roots of the music of the Inca trails, which is Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, and Argentina, that are connected physically by these roads, and look from the past into contemporary times and trace back the music, find it, because most of this music is scattered and lost or unknown. I mean, the majority.
And there were no recordings. So.
Nothing, no publications. So go and find them, have them published, have them available for people to play, and therefore for people to hear. That's, in brief, the end result of it. It's to bring music to life. But you have to
find it. Yes. And a lot of it came from little statues, right, from spiritual events such as burials. Mm-hmm. You found little images of people playing instruments. What sort of instruments were they? What did you discover?
Well, we know that in pre-Columbian cultures of Peru mainly, which was a vast empire, they had, for instance, pan flutes made out of clay, so baked, depending on where they were, in which geographical area. If they were in the coast, they would be of pelican bones. They could also be of metal, depending if the cultures had developed the work on silver and gold. And so those were the wind instruments. And then there were all kinds of percussion instruments, also in which the drums would have been made out of pottery with skins of animals and mm-hmm. sometimes with the skins of their enemies.
Oh, really?
Oh,
really?
Yes. Yes. Conch shells, if they were also mm-hmm. in coastal region. Trumpets, we have seen trumpets, literally, I mean, look like trumpets designed, you know, 4,000 years ago.
Yes, you're going back that far. 4,000 yeah. years yeah. is a very
yeah.
long time.
Yeah. So that's where it starts.
And did you personally go out to some of these villages, or do you have a team of people? This project reminds me a little bit of the Silk Road project of Yo-Yo Ma, where he followed the Asian Silk Road across Asia. This is a similar project, tracing
yes.
the music of South America, which mm-hmm. is so rich. I mean, there's something like, I read, 25,000 miles on the Inca Trail, and there must be incredible number of different styles and locales and types of music.
Well, as a matter of fact, the Smithsonian Institute in Washington just launched an exhibit last month that will last for 2 years called The Inca Road. And certainly my collaboration with Yo-Yo and the Silk Road led to solidifying this and was with his input and ideas that he made me sort of continue and solidify and build a structure like mm-hmm. he had done mm-hmm. with Silk Road. And one day, we've talked about, we're going to meet the Silk Road and the Inca Trails, which is geographically impossible, mm-hmm. but musically
you
possible.
Can do it. Right, right.
Yes. So that'll come on.
So the plan then is to take this as much as you can, recreate this very ancient music mm-hmm. and develop new classical pieces from it, because you have a Camino ensemble. Mm-hmm. So what is their repertoire then?
Well, normally in a concert, I mean, there's so much music that you have to choose always. But the first musical journey program starts with the influence of the most ancient sounds, for which I have worked with anthropologists, ethnomusicologists, experts in this area, and then cover our way through colonial times, which is from the 1500s onwards, through the independence of the countries, which happened in the 1800s, through the 20th century, which is really when things started becoming, you know, written down in paper, mm-hmm. and then to the 21st century. So usually these musical journeys cover at least 300 years of written music, plus the influence of millennia before that. Mm-hmm. And most of these programs are presented with multimedia, with films, with documentaries, with interviews, with pictures and all that, so that the actual journey is a visually physical journey.
Yes, the multimedia aspect is incredible. I watched one of these concerts, and there are images of where the places are. How is that cued? I mean, do you have a musician, or who does the cueing of the shift and changing of these images?
There's an assistant always working with me. And mm-hmm. most of them has been my colleague Andres Franco, who is now the principal conductor of the Caminos del Inca Ensemble. And yeah, it's all coordinated through careful studies.
Yeah, because things change, don't they? I mean, the tempi tonight may
sure.
be different to tomorrow
sure.
night, and you need some. That's the same with titles, of course,
which we have
at the opera. Well, I hope that you'll be able to bring the Camino Ensemble here to Santa Fe. That would be great. If people want to find out about this, they should Google?
The website is the best, caminosdelinca.org. And the Inca, we use the K as
yeah,
the
I-N-K-A,
letter.
I-N-K-A, yes.
Yes,
yeah, yeah,
because there was no spelling, you know. So all the spellings, even for the city of Cusco, are arbitrary.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, because the Quechua or Aymara had no writing system. So mm-hmm. the alphabet had to choose. Is it with the Q, with the C, with the K? So we decided to just, why not?
Yeah, Caminos del Inca. It looks good. It reads well. I'd like to wrap up then this morning, because we're out of time, I'm afraid, with a beautiful quote I found from someone from the Taki Institute. And this applies to all music, I think. He said, talking about this project, music is a sacred language that connects the human being, the human community, and the subtle, invisible world of the divine. It has a depth and a value which is still unknown, maybe not understood. Music responds to a profound need in the human being. Has that changed?
No, it's the same, because music is still the most powerful language.
Form of communication.
Yep.
Yes. Now, I absolutely believe that. So I'd like to thank you so much, Maestro Miguel Hoth-Bedoya, for being with us this morning on the Radio Cafe, and good luck with the rest of the remaining three shows of Cold Mountain at the Santa Fe Opera. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org.
Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.